All right. Let me turn the thing. Okay, beautiful thing. Welcome to our pre-show for Wednesday, the 15th. It would have been tax day, but oops, some other shit has come down. I got a cup of Joe in the kitty cat mug. I know, I'm a guy, I like cats. I like dogs too, but I had a little dog. He's not here. He's, you know, with his mom, and that's cool. Thing about getting a dog, man, not that, as soon as I start thinking about getting a dog, I'm like, how often am I here? Well, I'm here a lot, but that can change, you know, pretty rapidly here. Which reminds me of a tweet that I wanted to tweet out. Hold on for just a moment. Pardon the theatrics. Kent Shock, what's his name? Kent Shotnick. Anybody remember that guy? He said that once during an earthquake. He crawled under the desk. Before he went under the desk, he went, pardon the theatrics. And then he went, anyway. it was great. the cheap shot. Oh, well. All right. Welcome. So what are we going to do today? I had an idea. Actually, it was an idea. I was encouraged to develop the idea, which I don't know how much I'm going to develop it, but Don Berman let slip that he... used to work at a peep show when he first got to California from, where's Don from? He's from, New Berlin, Wisconsin. I remember I used to spend like inordinate amounts of time at a typewriter typing up show notes for each hour, right? And I came to find after many, many years that the best show notes were brief, that they were best just kind of whipped off on a notepad and not some big typed out thing, because the bigger, the more grandiose my effort at writing show notes, the more nervous I got and the more tensed up I got and the less free thinking I was. So if I could just whip things out on a notepad, it was way better. That came home to me one fine evening, a fine, beautiful summer evening in Minneapolis, Minnesota, when I was out in front of the station on 7th Avenue on... was it 7th Street and 2nd Avenue, or was it 2nd Street and 7th Avenue? Whatever. There at WCCR, I was out front on a beautiful summer evening, and Minneapolis is one of the few cities, because we worked in the city. There were buildings and stuff, you know, and yet there's people pushing baby carriages at 11 o'clock at night. It was a real trip. Not really something you'd see in L.A. But anyway, as I smoked that cigarette, a show idea, and I had all three of my hours planned, and I knew what I was going to do, and it wasn't going to be a bad hour, but all of a sudden I just got hit with a bolt of inspiration. It took me 30 seconds to flesh out what I wanted to do. I went in, and I did it, and it was a great hour. It was a great goddamn hour. And I went home that night, and I thought, Jesus Christ, you know, an idea could come to you like that. The show notes can be like that long, one sentence scribbled down on a napkin. You don't have to make it. You want to remind yourself what you want to talk about. That's the preeminent motivation. Okay, what am I going to talk? What am I going to do on the show tonight? You want to have some kind of, batting order that way, but you don't have to go into, because what I do is improvisational anyway. So how many fucking notes can you make on an improv? You know, you just... God damn, that's great coffee. Coffee and hot chocolate. That's my own little... It took off. He's running. Safe. Now, do I show you guys what I'm looking at here? That drives you guys nuts. You are... my fire, my one desire. I used to sing that with Catherine, my little stepdaughter, when I took her to school in the morning. That would come on the radio, and we'd sing it. We'd actually sing it together. She would sing the... I would sing the, tell me why, and she'd sing the, ain't nothing but a heartache. I don't know. Born performers, both of us. Catherine wanted to be a dancer too, man. She wanted to dance. And she was really into the whole, I don't know why she became a flight attendant and I suppose that's not a bad job. In fact, Catherine got a great gig. She's a union rep,
has done a great, great job with Alaska. But I remember how much she loved singing and dancing and stuff. I guess every kid does that, though, right? Or am I wrong about that? What do I fucking know? I was only a kid myself. But those were many, many days. But that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone. We had such happy times together. I can't believe it's gone forever. But wait till summer comes again. For me, you were the one. Oh, this is interesting. Clifton Webb is a Navy officer. What is this? What is this goddamn thing? All right, here we go. We had such happy times together. I can't believe it's gone forever. Wait till summer comes again. To me, you were the one. But that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone. That's kind of what it's supposed to look like. Right? Am I right or wrong? That's kind of what it's supposed to look like. Except, fucking, yeah, that's kind of what it's supposed to look like. It's better if I zoom in. Wait till summer comes again. What is that song, man? Now it's driving me nuts. To me, you were the one. But that was yesterday. That was Chad and Jeremy. That's the name of the guys. They were like a British group. What the fuck is this? The hell is this? Henry, what are you doing? Browse. Oh, I want to go to the store. I was in browse. We had such happy times together. I can't believe it's gone forever. Wait till summer comes again. There it is. Now, why is that not... What? What? What are they trying to do? Yeah, man, this is it. Yeah, man, this is it. Yeah, man, this is it. God, I don't know if that's the... Yeah? There you go. Yeah? There you go. Yeah?
I loved you all the summer through. I thought I'd found my dream in you. For me, you were the one. But that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone. Together, hand in hand, cross miles and miles of golden sand. But now it's over and done, 'cause that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone. We had such happiness together. I can't believe it's gone forever. Till summer comes again, I hope that you remember when our love had just begun. I loved you yesterday, and yesterday's gone.
There you go. Chad and Jeremy, they were from England. That was part of, they were part of the first wave of the British thing.
Because a lot of you young people, you don't get it, man. There was a time when America was the only rock and roll you heard was American rock and roll. Every other country in the world was like going, what's that? And everything we heard on the radio was American, you know. Now I was 10 years old. How old was I? The Beatles came to America. I was just turned 11. I just turned 11 years old when the Beatles played the Ed Sullivan Show on CBS television on Sunday night, February of 1964. And they'd already hit in England. They were a smash fucking hit in England. And they were from England. Now, they weren't the first English band to have a hit record in America. The Tornadoes had Telstar. That was a British instrumental group. Excuse me. That was a British instrumental group. Telstar. And there are a few groups that had hits, but nobody was saying, here's a British wave of... But the Beatles were the first band from England that became a smash, bona fide, major league hit, you know. And then it just started a flood of bands out of England. Dave Clark Five came next. Jerry and the Pacemakers came next. I can't remember all the bands that... the Rolling Stones came along, but not for a few months. The Beatles... Dave Clark Five, Jerry and the Pacemakers. Christ, I can't remember half these groups. It's guys like Peter and Gordon and Chad and Jeremy. And lots of... He was incredible. Oh, Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. These are groups you don't know, but now they had hit records in that period of time. Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. I was just thinking who the hell Sullivan had on. Because whatever the band was, I'm sure he was saying, yeah, I really like these bands. Just let's go. Come on. Well, Ed, you know, I don't give a fuck. I want to see every goddamn British band. Then the Rolling Stones were like, they were in and of themselves major because they were sort of the opposite of the Beatles. They were ruffian kind of guys and they were pissing on gas stations, all kinds of shit. I can't remember, all the groups, man. It was enormous amount of groups. Oh, the Kinks, they were next. And then came a show called Shindig on ABC. And that was fucking unbelievable because Shindig was devoted to rock and roll. So you didn't have to hang around and watch Ed Sullivan and all the shit that he had on, which was, you know. When Shindig hit the air with a disc jockey out of L.A. here, this guy, talk about the fucking world falling in your goddamn lap. Jimmy O'Neill was a disc jockey at KFWB when they were a rock station. What the fuck is this, man? And Jimmy O'Neill, he must have auditioned. He got the gig to be the host of Shindig. And Jimmy O'Neill was a dark-haired, good-looking guy. I think he was a Midwesterner. I don't know what time slot he was holding down at KFWB. Middays or some shit, maybe nights, I don't know. But he got the gig, man. And he became the national host of the show. And... that every band that was anything, man. Then came like individual singers like what was the chick, Sandy Shaw. She was another first waver. She did Girl Don't Come and who is that chick, You're My World, You're Everything. I don't remember what the hell her name was. Oh, and then Dusty Springfield came along. Those were all like the first couple of years of the British invasion. Stones, like I mentioned. I remember seeing the Kinks. That band. I loved the Kinks because they were obviously a rock and roll band. They didn't hold back at all. And and Dave Davies, of course, played the that kind of crunching rhythm / lead guitar that he played. Now he played lead. His brother Ray Davies was the rhythm guitar player. Yeah. And then what else? I don't know, man. And then it just was like, bang, you know, here we go. And then came the American bands that were influenced by them. And I would say the very first really successful American band influenced by the British bands, new band, was the Byrds. And the Beatles liked the Byrds a lot. They talked to Bob Dylan liked the Byrds because the Byrds covered a lot of Bob Dylan songs. The first hit they had was Mr. Tambourine Man. And they were like a British-style band. The long fucking hair, No American band ever had long hair like the Beatle guys, like the what do you call it, British guys. You know, they had the long hair and all of this nonsense, see? And so they, this is the Braves and the Indians. This is the one the Braves won. So, yeah. It was fun, man. That was a fun fucking time, dude. And then you know, it all got mishmashed together. Not mishmashed together. I would say the American bands. But then the San Francisco sound started. And that was like America's first real answer, I would say, to the British invasion in 1964. And then 1967, and a little bit before, came bands like the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, Country Joe and the Fish, 13th Floor Elevator, those wackos, you know, and Moby Grape. Moby Grape came along. They were like a Columbia Records creation, but they were great. And meanwhile, other bands that existed before the British invasion, some of them evolved successfully, like the Beach Boys. The Beach Boys went from being kind of a surf teeny thing, teeny bop thing, to a good band, serious compositions and you know, inventive songs. Good Vibrations was a very revolutionary song for the time. So yeah, you quickly knew who the musicians were, who the artists were, and who were just the, you know, goofy ass bullshit. Although the goofy ass bullshit, you know, there's always going to be that. I can't believe it's gone forever. Wait till summer's comes again.
Yes, Phil, I'm fine. It's great to be with you. I'm wondering how much more of this bullshit that I'm supposed to... How much of the test? Yes, Phil. Well, it's great to be with you. I'm Don Berman. Test. I'm only rolling off the high end on these things, you know. Testing. Well, Phil, it's great to be with you. Yeah, so what's your question? Yes, I worked at a peep show. Are you calling me, are you a homophobic?
No, I am not. You were the guy that brought it up.
Yes, I worked at a peep show.
Well, are you gay?
No, I'm not.
Well, are you homophobic?
I don't think so, since I worked at a fucking peep show! No, I'm not homophobic, all right? Look, guys. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Test. No, I'm not goddamned homophobic. I'm trying to tell you monkeys about me. Oh, shit. Don't do that.
Testing 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2.
Yes, Phil Don Berman, Channel 19 News.
My friends are like nuts. I'm on this fucking... So I guess I stopped my goddamn audacity and now I'm back again. All right, no problem. Let me see. What did we stop it on? What time? God damn it. I don't know. 9 minutes? Yeah, 9 minutes. I guess. I loved you yesterday and yesterday's gone. Don Berman here. Now, there's been an awful lot in the news. I mean, just this fucking corona. Kenny Miller, I was a teenage werewolf actor, was 85. Oh, yeah? Why the fuck? Bobby Vinton in the 1954 movie Surf Party. Attack of the Puppet People. Why did this just come popping up in my goddamn... This happened in 2017. Very weird.
I love you yesterday.
So what I wanted to do here is I got Don Berman, who used to work in a peep show. What time? 7:30. Dude, I gotta call Jackie, man. God damn it. There's never enough time. She's 3 hours ahead, man. What movie is this, man? This is blowing me away, dude. Info. The Man Who Never Was, starring Clifton Webb, Robert Fleming, British naval agents Clifton Webb, plant the corpse of a fake major with data. Oh, this is a true story. This is a whack story. This is a true story, yeah. Britain got the bright idea. I don't know. I never remember how successful this was, but I think it was pretty successful. And they actually gave this man a military burial, I think. And they found the body. They used the body of a homeless man, literally a man who had died and after eating rat poison by mistake in a warehouse. He must have died an agonizing death, but he died, and they got his body out of the morgue. Asked, well, who is this guy? And the British Navy was told, we don't know who he is. He's a John Doe, if you will. He died. This were the circumstances of his death. So, well, this guy's perfect. He was the right size. His body was not decomposed too much, et cetera, et cetera. And they used this man's body. They dressed him in a naval uniform. They planted secret documents on him, faked secret documents. And I believe that they just planted his body as if he'd washed up on a piece of beach in Portugal. I think that's where he was found by the Portuguese authorities, who then immediately, being a neutral power at that time, I don't know how neutral they were, they contacted the Germans. Because I think their neutrality was guaranteed by Germany as long as they kept their fucking noses clean. And Spain, too. Spain was a big ally of Germany's. So the Spanish kept their noses clean. The Portuguese reported this maybe to the Spanish. The Spanish told the Germans something. But the Germans took possession of the man's body and these so-called top-secret documents. And this became, and it misled the Germans. I think it had to do with the invasion of southern Europe. In other words, the invasion of Italy, or the landings in Sicily as opposed to Sardinia. They weren't quite sure. The Germans weren't quite sure where the Allies were going to land. And I think it had to do with that. I could be wrong. But it was a major operation that misled the Germans enough whereby they did not know where the British were going to land, where the Allies were going to land. This man who was taken out of this morgue, this homeless, nameless man, I think they found out who he was. I think they found his name. And they, after many, many decades, I believe, and I always like telling these stories where I don't really know the full story. Don't you love it when I do this? You guys can look it up. They accorded him military honors and found out what his real name was and accorded him, I think, a military burial. I don't know whether the Germans, what they did. Forgive me, I don't know what happened to the body, but they gave him respect and dignity in death that he never had in life. And, of course, had he been walking around upright and conscious, would he have ever volunteered for anything like this? Probably not. Who's going to volunteer to, you know, but... Point being, this is Oral Hershiser. I don't even remember this cat's name, and I was a big Dodger fan back in the day. Oral Hershiser is pitching for the GD Indians of the American League of the Thing, is what I'm trying to say, okay?
This is Dr. Jim Sadler. Yeah, Dr. Sadler.
But, you know, I don't know. We never do. What are your pandemic fuck-ups, did we? I can't believe she's gone forever. Wait till summer comes again. I know that you will love me good. I don't know if the lyrics are. For me. Now, where are we, man? I'm looking for my characters. Where are you? Where are you? Where? There they are. Oh, okay, good. Oral Hershiser. I don't know a lot about baseball. I was wondering if you could help me, Phil. Was it Oral Hershiser? Or Oral Her... Hershiser. You see what I did there?
But that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone.
Now I got a call. I don't know how late she's going to be awake, though, you know? Because, the first one I got, Dawn Berman. Dawn is going to be in the newsroom, right? So I don't know, however, if this is going to be... That's the newsroom. That's the newsroom, and I'm going to move that there. All right, and... then I need TV. There it is. I love use the shit out of these stupid. 1988 with the Dodgers, Oral Hershiser led the NL in wins, 23. Innings pitched and complete games, 15. Sue 67. Yeah, he was great, man. Bulldog, they used to call him. They called him Bulldog. Who won this goddamn World Series? The Braves did. The Braves beat him, didn't they? You know, there's Dave Justice. God, look at all these old Braves, man. What a ball club that was. Jesus Christ. What a ball club that was. Who was that guy Justice dating? Wasn't he going out with Halle Berry? He was. Look at these guys. Ryan Klesko, batted 310, 23 home runs. I mean, come on, 95. Let's find out who did it. 1995 World Series. I want to say the Braves won. In fact, I know they did. 4-2. Now, let's take a look at these Cleveland Indians, because when did they win? This is the 95 Indians. Mike Hargrove was their manager. It was a good ball club, but local rated Herb Score was still alive and well. Jose Mesa was their most outstanding pitcher that year, finished second in the voting. Now, how many fucking... Let's just talk about the Cleveland Indians here for a second. They began life 1901. Did they really? Yeah, the Indians have not won since 1948. God damn, dude. They won the AL in 2016. How did I miss that one? Who'd they play in the series? They beat the Blue Jays 4-1. Then they went on to what? Lose their fucking ass to somebody. Who knows? Oh, that was the Cubs. The Indians and the Cubs. Only two. 1920, 1948. Man, that's a lot of goddamn years. You know, it's funny. You come from in our town, L.A., you know, Dodgers. Even the Angels won a World Series. But to go all those fucking years, Terry Francona, what is this, man? Okay. So my question that I'm looking for is, they began life as who? The name Indian originated from a request by club owner Charles Summers to baseball writers to choose a new name to replace Cleveland Naps. It was a rival nickname the fans gave to the Cleveland Spiders while Louis Sandman was playing for the team. A nickname for the Indians included the Tribe, the Wahoos, whatever they were. The franchise originated in 1894 as the Grand Rapids Rustlers, minor league of the Western League. The team relocated to Cleveland in 1900 was renamed the Cleveland Lake Shores. The Western League itself was renamed the American League while continuing its minor league status. One of the American League's 8 charter franchises, the major league incarnation of the club was founded in 1901. Originally called the Cleveland Bluebirds, the team played in League Park until moving permanently to Cleveland Stadium in 1946. At the end of the 2019 season, they had a regular season franchise record of 9. Indians went 22 consecutive games in 2017, September 14th, August, the longest winning streak in American League history. 22 consecutive wins. That was in the end of the 2017 season. Cleveland baseball prior to the Indian franchise, they had a bunch of shit is what they had. Who gives a shit? What about L.A. baseball prior to the Dodgers and Angels? Who gives a fuck? They had the Hollywood Stars. They had another team called the L.A. Angels. The Spiders owner bought the St. Louis Browns with the only two clubs at the same time. The Browns were renamed the Perfectos and restocked with Cleveland talent. Get out of here. The Cleveland Infants. Boy, there's a funny name. They were in the Players League, which was well attended in some cities, but club owners lacked the confidence to continue beyond the one season. The Cleveland Infants. Oh. All right, man, I'm ready. I've fucked around enough here. Roger Peckinpah, Stan's grandfather, Bob Lemon, and... Biff Cranapple, interesting, goddamned interesting. I'm a big franchise, I don't know what it is, I have this real thing for, I love to know the history of franchises. I don't know anything about baseball or football, not really, but ask me about franchises, I can tell you where they're from, the years, all kinds of shit. I didn't know that about the Indians, though. And I'm really only really strong with football franchises, to be honest with you. Baseball, kinda. Basketball, forget it. Hockey, are you kidding? You know, how many teams were in Montreal? How many teams were in fucking the Montreal, whatever? Testing 1, 2, 3.